Neuroticism, it's one of the five personality traits of the five-factor model. What is neuroticism? What are the advantages and disadvantages of neuroticism? And how do we navigate through negative emotion? Well, we're going to be talking all about that on today's episode of Real Talk. Let's go. Welcome back to another episode of Real Talk with Kane Adams. We are right in the middle of our personality series. We have been talking about agreeableness, about conscientiousness, extroversion, and now we're up to neuroticism. Last week we talked about low extroversion. So what are the advantages and disadvantages of being low in extroversion? And I suppose a little recap is that extroversion is a tendency to be sensitive to positive emotion. Whereas neuroticism, which is what we're going to be talking about today, is a sensitivity to negative emotion. And so we're going to be talking all about that. So remember that the goal of positive emotion is to move us towards, or motivate us to move towards a desired goal. Whereas the purpose of negative emotion is to keep us safe and to help us to detect threats that might come along the way, on the way to our goal that we are moving towards. So we're going to be talking about neuroticism. And remember, something I mentioned last week and the week before as well is that positive emotion and negative emotion, they operate on different systems of the brain. So if you're sensitive to positive emotion, that doesn't mean that you're automatically going to be not sensitive to negative emotion or vice versa. Someone can be sensitive to both positive and negative emotion. Someone could be not sensitive to either of them, or you could have a mix where you could be sensitive to positive but not negative, and then vice versa. So we're going to answer three questions like we have been the past few episodes. What is neuroticism? What are the advantages and disadvantages of being high in neuroticism? And what are the advantages and disadvantages of being low in neuroticism? And we're also going to talk about navigating through negative emotion as well on this episode. Because this is the personality trait that does deal with negative emotion. So we're going to talk a little bit about anxiety and depression as well. Just a reminder that a lot of this material has been collated together from the teachings of Dr. Jordan Peterson, which I'm sure you are familiar with. And so if you want to know more about neuroticism, I've placed a link in the description that you can click on and learn about it in more detail. And again, if you haven't taken the test, the five-factor personality test, you can take that at understandmyself.com. The link is in the description below. Okay, so let's get into it. What is neuroticism? Neuroticism. Quite simply, neuroticism is sensitivity to negative emotion. So if you are high in neuroticism, you're going to be more sensitive to negative emotion than someone who is low in neuroticism. What do we mean? What are some examples of negative emotion? So these are things like anxiety, depression, fear, grief, stress, pain, frustration. All of these things are examples of negative emotion. So if you are high in neuroticism, you are more likely to experience those emotions. So let's break it down. So neuroticism is broken down into two subtraits, which are withdrawal and volatility. What's the difference between that? Withdrawal and volatility. Withdrawal is associated with the animal behavior of freezing. And so, animals tend to freeze when they can sense a threat or sense a predator is amongst them. You can imagine, like, say, a deer in the headlights, right? So you've got a deer crossing the road, you've got the car coming up, it senses a threat, it doesn't run away, instead it just freezes. And when a deer or any animal is in a frozen state, they're not in a relaxed state at all. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Their muscles are tense, their heart rate's up, their blood is pumping, and they're basically ready to bolt in whatever direction they possibly can when the opportune time comes. And so it's a state of being frozen, which is obviously going to be a very taxing way to live that way. If you live that way long enough, then there's no surprise that you might develop some sort of chronic illness because your body is tense all the time. And so that's withdrawal. Volatility is associated more with defensive aggression. So there's a difference between predatory aggression and defensive aggression. So predatory aggression is more related to somebody who is low in agreeableness. So predatory aggression is where you are aggressive in order to get something that you want. So you're aggressive towards a person in order to fulfill your own selfish desires, and so it's kind of you're proactive. You're the you're You're not the victim. You're the perpetrator in that regard, I suppose. Whereas defensive aggression is more associated to stopping someone or something taking advantage of you or hurting you, which is going to be related to neuroticism opposed to low agreeableness. So that's defensive aggression. You can imagine a good example, actually, that can kind of highlight the two, withdrawal and aggression and volatility, would be if you're chasing a cat around with a broom. So you've got a cat running around the house, you're chasing it with a broom, it's going to start out in that withdrawal phase where it's running away, it's flight mode, right? It's running away, and there comes a point where you might corner the cat in a corner, right, with the broom, and the cat suddenly changes tactics, and it goes from running away into this wild defensive aggression, or it might pounce on you, or it might try to attack you, right? And so that's kind of a switch between the withdrawal into the volatility, defensive aggression to protect itself. It launches and lunges at you. And so that's kind of what volatility is. It's people who are volatile, they're touchy people. So they're put off by criticism quite easily. They react or overreact. It's kind of this hyper-reactivity to frustration and to disappointment and to pain. And so that's volatility. I suppose you could say in relation to the sympathetic nervous system that withdrawal is related to the flight and freeze mode, whereas volatility is related to the fight mode. So people who are launching more into fight mode with the sympathetic nervous system would be higher in volatility, whereas people who launch into flight or freeze mode with their sympathetic nervous system would be more higher up in withdrawal. Okay, so some common behaviors. Common behaviors among people who are high in withdrawal. They tend to worry about things. They feel depressed and sad. They cry often. They struggle to work through grief. They can be easily overwhelmed. They're sensitive to threat. They can be very self-conscious. And then some common behaviors among people who are high in volatility. They're irritable. They can be easily frustrated. They struggle to regulate emotions. They change mood quickly and frequently. They can be overly reactive, can be aggressively defensive, and they can be volatile. So you can kind of see the negative emotion amongst all of those and those two subjects particularly. So, and I'm sure you might know some people. When you read these traits, I'm sure you might know some people who are like this. You could be one of those people. Okay, let's talk through some advantages and disadvantages of being high in neuroticism. And I'm sure with the list that I've just read, you're probably thinking, well, are there any advantages of being high in neuroticism? Probably not. But there are. Yes, there are some advantages. So you don't need to worry about that. Let's talk about the purpose of negative emotion. So I mentioned before, the purpose of negative emotion is to keep us safe. It's to help us to detect threat. That's the purpose of it. And so if positive emotion is to move us towards a desired goal and negative emotion is to keep us safe from threat, sometimes it could be natural to think that, well, wouldn't the optimal state of being be where we only experience positive emotion and not experience negative emotion at all? But that wouldn't be the optimal state of being at all, because if we only experience positive emotion, then you'd find yourself dead in a month, because you wouldn't be able to detect any threat whatsoever coming your way. And we need that. We need negative emotion to help us stay safe, to keep us alive, basically. If you're standing on the middle of the road and you've got a car hurtling towards you, you're not going to rely on positive emotion to keep you safe. You're going to rely on your negative emotion, which is connected to your sympathetic nervous system, to tell you to take action and to get off the road, right, and to jump. And so we need that. We need our negative emotion to help us remain safe. And so people who are sensitive to negative emotion, i.e. high in neuroticism, that's a massive advantage. Because people who are high in neuroticism, they have this acute sense to threat and can calculate the consequences of an action very quickly and very efficiently, meaning that they can navigate through life in a much safer way than most people. Neurotic people, they carefully evaluate the potential risks of their actions, which could lead them to perhaps, I suppose, more prudent decision-making and, I guess, a reduced likelihood of engaging in reckless things like reckless behavior that could prove detrimental to your life. So Neurotic people, they're able to minimize loss and minimize pain as much as possible. And they are, for the most part, able to avoid getting hurt quite effectively. So they're quite successful at that, of avoiding being hurt, because they're so acute to the sense of threat. So that's a good thing. And if you combine high neuroticism with high conscientiousness, despite the OCD behaviors that you'd probably experience with that, you'd find that you'd have someone who's a very careful and astute planner, someone who works hard, they plan well, they're able to see all the future pitfalls before anybody else, which is really valuable to have somebody like that in a team, particularly in a workforce, because you have, maybe you're embarking on a project as a team, and you've got someone who can see and understand what is going to derail the project because they're acute to it. They're acute to that sense of threat. And you need people like that. I suppose you could say they have a sense of discernment in that regard, because they can sense what could possibly derail the project or derail the plan or the event or whatever it is. And they can point those out early so that you can avoid making some dumb decisions. So embrace the neurotic people who are on your team. All right, let's take a look at some disadvantages. So obviously, I suppose the problem is that with negative emotion, of course, all of us run the risk of experiencing negative emotion in far excess to its function. And this is typically and especially true for those who are high in neuroticism. So if your sensitivity to threat becomes too acute, then you run into the danger of detecting everything as a threat. And if you detect everything as a threat, then you're not going to be making any decisions. You're not going to be moving forward in life because you could get taken out at any moment. And we can see how this happens to a lot of people, right? If you're high in neuroticism, you're far more likely to experience negative emotions such as anxiety, depression, grief, frustration, anger, and pain. All of those negative emotions, which will cripple you if you do not know how to manage it. So I suppose just as important as negative emotion is in our lives, we need to ensure that we don't let it grow excess out of its function and let it run our lives. I want to talk about two specific emotions that we can feel that I'm sure a lot of people have questions about, and it's the most, I wouldn't say the most common, but it's maybe the most debilitating, actually, emotions, and that's anxiety and depression. So let's take them each in turn. Let's start with anxiety. What is anxiety? I suppose anxiety can be best described as a fear of uncertainty, or I like to say a fear of chaos. And I've mentioned this, I think I've mentioned this before in one of the other episodes, that life is made up of a spectrum of order versus chaos. And the optimal state of being would be somewhere in the middle, because you get people who are far too orderly, particularly those who are high in conscientiousness, right? Because one of the subtraits is orderliness, and they run the risk of being too orderly. And then, of course, you have chaotic, which would, I suppose it would typically, it probably wouldn't be necessarily in relation to neuroticism. But all that to say, so the optimal state of being is to be in the middle, because if you're too orderly, then you're going to find yourself a slave to your own tyrannical structure of your life. Your life will be a tyranny. Whereas if you're too much into chaos and then you have no order in your life, then your life's just going to be anarchy. You're going to be slave to anarchy and everything, anything goes, which, of course, you can see the danger in that as well. So the optimal place is to be in the middle. Anxiety tends to be afraid of that chaos, which is why you find people who are anxious tend to err towards the orderly side, sometimes even too much. And so it's kind of a fear of chaos, because what comes with chaos is uncertainty. So it's also a fear of uncertainty. And I suppose this is why people who are high in neuroticism, they crave boundaries. Because when you have boundaries in life, when you can see the clear lines, the clear box, in other words, a place of order, right? You can see the boundary lines, you can see the confined space, then it's easier to be able to detect the threats within that confined space, because you don't need to worry about the threats outside of it, because you're protected by these boundary lines. And so that's why if you move the boundary away, you take the boundary away, then all of a sudden, threat can come from anywhere. And so it's very difficult to be able to detect threat and where it can come from, which is obviously going to have detrimental effects on people who are high in neuroticism. They're going to freak out. And this is why you might have someone who's Well, let's say someone's just started a new job. And so they might be anxious about starting this new job. They're not sure what the people are going to be like. They're not sure what the coworkers are going to be like, or the boss, or the environment, or the culture. And so they might be nervous. But if you might have someone who doesn't have a job, and they're looking for a job, and they may not even be looking for a job because they're so frozen. And this person is going to be 10 times more anxious than the one who's just started a job, because it's like, you know, at least having a job has some boundaries there, right? You've got a secure job, so at least you've got a form of boundary. But if you have no job, it's like there's no boundaries. There's no confined space. There's no box to dwell in. And so anything goes. The threat can come from anywhere. So that's why someone, say, who doesn't have a job would be 10 times more anxious than someone who's just starting a new job. And I suppose this is also why neurotic people can be very indecisive as well, because there's a fear of making a decision, particularly if you're high in orderliness and low in assertiveness as well when it comes to indecisiveness, because you're afraid of making a decision because you're afraid of making the wrong one. And if you make the wrong one, you have to deal with the negative emotions that come with that wrong decision. So perhaps you think in your mind, it's better to not make a decision and remain where I am than it is to make a decision and have to deal with the uncertainty with it. Because if I remain where I am, at least I can maximize the predictability of the short-term future. At least I know what's going to happen. At least I can remain in a place of comfort and safety. Whereas if I make a decision and it ends up being the wrong one, then I have to face not only the uncertainty, but also the negative emotion that comes with it. And so, but of course, you can see how that breaks down. If you don't make any decisions in life, then you're never going to move forward in life. So this is the kind of stuff that people who are high in neuroticism or people who experience anxiety would be dealing with. So how do we offset that? How do we deal with anxiety? How do we manage it? And I don't like the word manage because, you know, it's not something that you necessarily want to live with. It's not something that should be controlling you. It's something that you need to be controlling, that you need to have your foot on its neck in that regard. And that's why I don't like people saying things like, you know, anxiety is that little monster that's your friend that you need to manage. You know, it's not something that you want to allow to control your life. So three things that we can learn from Jordan Peterson in regards to offsetting anxiety in your life. Number one, start with creating a reasonable goal and map out how you're going to achieve it. So when you map out a plan, well, when you create a goal, right, you have somewhere where you want to go. You're at A and you want to go to B. So start off with creating a goal. And then once you have your goal, you want to map out a plan as detailed as you possibly can. So you break down those goals into sub-goals and then sub-goals after that. Because when you have a plan, then you can maximize the predictability of how you're going to navigate through towards that goal, which is going to give you a sense of safety and a sense of comfort, which is what you want, right, as someone who's anxious. And so, create a goal. Make a plan of how you're going to achieve that goal. And you'll minimize the amount of uncertainty as well, I think, when it comes to achieving that goal. You can't minimize the uncertainty down to zero because that's impossible. And you want a sense of uncertainty. You want a little bit of uncertainty in life. I mean, if you had no uncertainty in life, then life would be boring. You wouldn't be having an adventure, and that's what you want. You want to have an adventure in life. And to have an adventure, it requires at least some form of uncertainty. And so, but obviously too much uncertainty is going to derail you as an anxious person. But you need it to grow. A quote from the great philosopher, Dr. Tony Robbins. I don't know if he's a doctor or not, but anyway, I thought this was a great quote. The quality of your life is directly related to how much uncertainty you can comfortably handle. And he's absolutely right. So, you know, well, you could say one thing that is certain in life is that you are going to experience uncertainty because you can't avoid it. And so how you handle that uncertainty is going to determine the quality of your life. And I guess, like I mentioned before, is that life is meant to be an adventure. You know, it's not meant to be a cocoon that you hide yourself in and hide away from anything that's scary. It's meant to be an adventure. And if you want to have an adventure in life, then you have to face uncertainty because that's what makes life adventurous. And with adventure comes quality of life. Okay, so that's number one, which is create a goal and then map out a plan on how you're going to achieve it. Number two, do not underestimate the utility of a well-defined routine. So if you're dealing with anxiety, creating a routine is one of the best things that you can do, because what it does is it offsets the amount of uncertainty that you would experience in everyday life. It maximizes predictability, which will help with emotional stability, right? It helps keep you emotionally stable. And obviously, you don't want to go too hard out with this, you know, and create such a rigid routine that nothing could possibly move. But you want to have enough of a routine that it becomes a foundation for you. You have enough of a predictability in your daily life that you're stable, and then you can explore the margins from there and start to move forward in life at a more comfortable pace. And that can be found in a routine, which is really important when it comes, to emotional stability. So, I mean, what would a routine look like? Well, honestly, it starts out with the simple stuff, you know. Go to bed every night at the same time. Get up every morning at the same time. Get 8 hours of sleep every night. Eat 3 meals a day at the same time. And proper meals, right? Like not just a piece of toast here and there, but proper meals. 7:30 in the morning, every morning, have breakfast. 12:30 in the afternoon, have lunch. 6:30 p.m. at night, have dinner. Exercise. You know, go for a walk every second morning or whatever it is, or go to the gym every third day or whatever it is. But honestly, I can guarantee that if you just implement those three things, so sleeping 8 hours a night at the same time every night, 3 meals a day, proper meals at the same time every day, and regular exercise, you implement those three things, 70 to 80% of your anxious or anxiety problems are going to go away. And I don't mean that from a trauma perspective. I mean that from a personality neurotic perspective. You do that, you're going to have enough stable predictability that you're going to be able to explore the margins quite effectively and safely as well. So, and then final step number three, you want to expose yourself to unfamiliar situations voluntarily. So there's been a lot of research done actually about this, where the difference between people who have engaged in an event or a circumstance voluntarily compared to someone who's engaged in that same event involuntarily, and the effects that it has on our bodies, as well as the systems that are used to be able to navigate through that situation. And so you might take someone like who puts a hand, you know, in a bucket of icy water, right? And they've done tests about this using these exact examples where, you know, you grab someone, you tell someone to put their hand into a bucket of icy water. They've given 5 minutes to be able to prepare. They know what they're doing. And then at the opportune time, they dunk their hand in, right? And compared to someone who they might sit them down on a bench, they have the bucket of water there covered with a cloth, and then without, you know, all of a sudden they unveil the bucket of water, grab the person's hand and dunk it in for them, right? So that's an involuntary response, or involuntary, you know, placing the hand in the bucket. So, and the difference, and it's quite remarkable that the body uses different systems for voluntary exposure and involuntary exposure. So people who would expose themselves voluntarily to a situation or event use the system that is related to approach and challenge or adventure in the body, which I wouldn't be surprised is connected probably to positive emotion as well. Whereas people who are involuntary putting their hand into the bucket, for example, using the system that's more related to defensive aggression and withdrawal, or the sympathetic nervous system, right? The fight, flight, and freeze system. And that's massive. That's huge, because that's in relation to life as well. Like I mentioned before about uncertainty, is that we guaranteed uncertainty in life, and so it's our decision whether we face that uncertainty voluntarily or if we face it involuntarily. So the things that we're afraid of, do we face it voluntarily or do we face them involuntarily? Because basically we can choose. We can choose, right? Either we can choose to face our fears and to face our uncertainties in life and use the system that is in relation to approach and challenge, which is far better to deal with, or we do it through involuntarily. We face uncertainty kicking and screaming, and instead you know, go through hell with our sympathetic nervous system that's related to defensive aggression and withdrawal. And so, so it's like, what will you choose, you know? And that's useful to think about. Here's a quote, actually, from Jordan Peterson, which I think sums this up really well. He says, "When you face what scares you and approach it voluntarily, you're indicating to your anxiety systems that you are more competent than the thing is dangerous." And that's right. So when you are approaching something voluntarily, you're telling yourself that you are in control and that you are the one that is deciding to do this. And when you do that, you have a sense of inner resilience that can help you to do what you're doing, right? Whereas if you're doing something involuntarily, then what you're telling your brain is, I have no control over this. And this is happening to me. I'm not happening to it, which is obviously going to trigger the sympathetic nervous system. So all that to say, that's just something to note, that when it comes to anxiety and fear, you're much better off to face it voluntarily of your own volition than you are to face it involuntarily, kicking and screaming, because that's not going to be a healthy way to live for you. Find something that you are afraid of, or that would be a sense of uncertainty that you would normally shy away from, as small and as menial as it might be, and chase it and enter into it and expose yourself to it voluntarily. It might be something as simple as, you know, you might go to a restaurant and order the same thing every time. Order something different. Do something different and do it in your own volition. Do it on your own accord. And the more you do that, even just the little things, then you're going to find that resilience is going to grow in you and build in you. You're going to build in resilience. So those are those three steps to help offset your anxiety. Make a plan, get a routine going, and expose yourself to danger voluntarily. Okay, depression. What about depression? So depression is a sense of hopelessness, sadness, and it's a loss of interest in engaging in pleasurable or social activities. I suppose any activities for that matter. It's complete demotivation to moving towards a goal, because you completely lose sight of the goal. So that's kind of like, in a nutshell, what depression is. How do you get out of it? So I suppose I will make this disclaimer here that I'm not a licensed psychologist or therapist or counselor. So my first advice, very first advice for someone who is experiencing high levels of depression would be to talk to someone. Obviously, talk to a family member, talk to a friend, talk to a therapist or a counselor or a pastor or someone. Tell someone. And it's really important that you do that. It's not something that you want to be fighting or battling with on your own in your own head. You got to get it out of your head and in an articulate manner to someone, so that you can get some help. But here's something that could help you. So to bring yourself out of depression, it's very similar to bringing yourself out of anxiety. Start by creating a goal, and then begin to map out a plan on how you're going to achieve that goal. And this is the most important part, is that you want to break down that goal into manageable tasks. And I talked about this in the very first episode of last season, about reducing your ambition. Take the goal, reduce it down into manageable tasks, because a goal is made up of many sub-goals underneath it, and then underneath those sub-goals, more sub-goals than sub-goals, and all those sub-goals together kind of create the big meta overall goal. And this is why, you know, you tell someone who's depressed, well, you got to clean up your life, you know? And it's like, well, how the hell do you do that? Where do you begin with that? You know, and it's too much. It's too much. You've probably heard Jordan Peterson talking about, you know, the importance of cleaning up your room. You need to clean up your room. And I think a reason why he does that is because he recognizes that goals are made up of sub-goals, and then those sub-goals are made up of sub-goals underneath it. So you might have a goal, and then that might have five sub-goals underneath it, and then underneath those, they each of those sub-goals have five sub-goals attached to those as well, and it keeps going down. And so it's like all of these sub-goals together make up the big meta goal on top. And sometimes you need to start there. You need to start at some of the sub-goals, right? So if you're dealing with depression, cleaning up your room might be too much for you. So you start to travel down the sub-goals until you find one that you are willing to implement and you're willing to take to put into action. For example, you might ask, okay, well, are you willing to clean your room? No. Okay. Are you able to clean half your room? No. Are you able to clean the closet? No. Okay. Are you able to look at the left-hand side of the closet? No. Okay. Are you able to take two pieces of clothes, you know, a t-shirt and some pants, fold them up and place them on top of your bed? Yes, I can do that. Okay. That's where we start. And then, you know, you move on from there into the left-hand side of the closet, and then you move from the left-hand side of the closet into the full closet, and etc. And then before you know it, you cleaned your room. And it's important to approach it that way, because otherwise it's just going to be too much to say just clean your room, or like I said before, clean your life. And there's going to be zero motivation to do that if the goal is unachievable in your own mind because of the state of depression that you're in. I read an interesting quote, actually, that was it's not actually on the self-authoring course, funny enough, Jordan Peterson again, and it says this: having well-defined goals increases your chances of experiencing positive emotion, as people experience most of their hope, joy, curiosity, and engagement as a consequence of pursuing valued goals and not, as people generally think, by attaining them. And man, that's interesting. I find that so fascinating, because normally you would think that when you attain the goal is when you feel happy, but it's not. Attaining the goal doesn't engage the positive system. It's when you actually start pursuing the goal. So what that means is that if you want to engage that positive system in your life, which someone who is depressed would need to, then all you need to do is create a goal and actually just take the first step towards going towards the, achieving that goal, and the positive emotion will be triggered, it will be engaged. And that's why it's interesting when I hear people often, and I've experienced this myself. I know what it feels like to experience depression, so I have experienced this myself, where when you are in a place of depression or in a depressed state, you don't want to do anything. You just want to do nothing. That's why people who are depressed often lie in bed all day. Literally, they can't get out of bed. You have no motivation to do anything whatsoever. And there can be a temptation to think, okay, you know, once I get better, then I'll go to the gym. Or once I get better, then I will wash the car. Or once I get better, then I will get a job. Or I will go on this date, or whatever it might be. But you're not going to get better if you have that mindset, because it's in doing those things that you will get better. So it's, if you find yourself in a state of depression, it's in that moment that you need to think to yourself, okay, what is it that I can do, as little and as small as it might be, that will engage the positive emotion system that's going to help me to get out of this depression spiral? And so that's what you need to think about. So that's just something to think about with depression. Obviously, there's way more into it, into depression. So like I said, if you are experiencing high levels of depression, then I would encourage you to see a counselor or see a therapist, or at least just tell someone so that you can share the struggle together with someone, not on your own. Okay. What about low neuroticism? So that's high neuroticism. Let's take a look at some advantages and disadvantages of low neuroticism. All right. Common behaviors among people who are low in withdrawal: they live life in the moment, or they go with the flow. They're emotionally stable. They don't cry often. They're not easily overwhelmed. They're not sensitive to threat. They're confident in who they are. They keep their head in a crisis. And then some common behaviors among people who are low in volatility: they are calm. They're not easily frustrated. They can regulate their emotions quickly. They have a stable mood. They're not easily agitated, or they're difficult to provoke. They don't let grievances get under their skin, and they are able to let go. So the advantages of being low in neuroticism, they're probably quite obvious. If you're low in neuroticism, you're not going to be sensitive or as sensitive to negative emotion. You're going to be emotionally stable and secure, which you can see how obviously that's going to be a massive advantage. You're less likely to become upset or anxious or stressed by challenging situations. You're going to carry a calm demeanor, which will keep others and yourself at ease during stressful times. And people want to be around people like that. You know, I think about, well, you think about massive crisis, you know, like something like 9/11. You know, you're in the tower, the towers have been hit. People are running down the stairs to try and save their lives. And if you're in that situation, you don't want to be around someone who's high neuroticism. You don't want to be around a neurotic person because you're just going to panic. You don't. That is not the time to be surrounded by negative emotion. You want to be around someone who is emotionally stable, who's able to transcend the emotions and look over them and to be able to work out what the best action is, the best course of action is to take. You need someone who's going to have their head in a crisis. Or keep their head in a crisis, I should say. People who are low in neuroticism are emotionally stable, and that is a massive advantage in that regards. They're not going to let things sway them, whether it's setbacks towards pursuing a goal, whether it's a crisis, whether it's a clash in personality even, they're just going to keep going forward. And they can stay calm in quite stressful situations, which again is what we need. And we need people like that. Okay, let's take a look at some disadvantages really quickly. So there's kind of only really one main one. The main disadvantage to low neuroticism is that because you're not sensitive to negative emotion, then you're not sensitive to threat. And so you're more likely to take risks, especially if you're high in extroversion. And if those risks don't pay off, then you could find yourself in a lot of trouble. So in a way, I suppose, being high in extroversion, being high in neuroticism is would be too much threat, and being low in neuroticism would be not enough. And so if you don't have enough threat, well, if you can't detect threat, then you're going to be taking all sorts of risks, which is not a bad thing if they pay off. If they don't pay off, then it could derail your life. So that's quite a big disadvantage. I suppose the upside to that is that if you are derailed from moving towards your goal, then you're not worried about it too much because you're emotionally stable. But of course, there are times where you should be worried. And it's at those times which sometimes you're not able to detect or determine when those times are, I suppose we could say, because it's not natural to your temperament to be able to recognize that. So people who are low in neuroticism run the risk of becoming apathetic and treating life in a blasé fashion. And there are times when you need to take things very seriously. There are times when things are happening or a crisis is happening where you actually do need to be a bit anxious or a bit afraid, which can push you into action. And so sometimes you do need that. So that, I guess, could be a disadvantage for someone who's low in neuroticism. Anyway, okay, so a lot of information today about neuroticism. I hope that's helped you because, like I mentioned at the start of the series, was that a reason why I really like this personality psychometric test with the Big Five is because it's the only one that I know of that deals with negative emotion. All the others seem to gloss over it or not take negative emotion into account at all, but negative emotion is a massive aspect of our lives, huge aspect of our lives, and our personality is absolutely tied to it. So it's important to explore how negative emotion can affect us from a personality perspective. So I hope that you've enjoyed it. Next week, we're going to be talking about our final trait, which is openness to experience, all about intellect and creativity. And so, looking forward to that. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you next week for another episode of Real Talk.